We'll see if I'm right. VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from John Russell, as well as Brian Lynn, who presents this week's science report. Later, we hear the next episode of our American History program, The Making of a Nation. But first, students who are working toward a master's degree in education at the University of Washington are required to take a technology class. Before last year, that technology class was not seen as especially important. Then the coronavirus health crisis hit. Schools across the country went to online learning. Suddenly, materials from the class were being included in other classes. "It's become so relevant, and it's staying that way," said Anne Beatlers. She directs Washington's master's program for secondary education. The pandemic is already creating lasting effects on the education of future teachers. Many U.S. educator preparation programs are including more information about digital tools, online learning, and mental and emotional wellness in their classes. School system leaders across the U.S. are hoping to offer in-person teaching as widely as possible this year. But education experts say the increased focus on technology will improve teacher quality no matter what happens with the pandemic. The education school at Iowa's Drake University has introduced a class about best practices in online teaching. Other schools say they have added digital tools, video conferencing, and educational technology to their classes. They aim to help future educators do the same. Jennifer Krawick is Director of Teacher Preparation Programs at the University of Miami in Florida. She said, "I think it's our responsibility to train teachers to be able to do that. And if they find themselves teaching face-to-face, nobody's hurt by additional information about teaching online." Southern Methodist University in Texas plans to make sure those who complete its education program get trained using Google Classroom. Teachers at New York University have become more purposeful about explaining how and why they choose to use certain digital tools. At North Carolina State University's College of Education, instructors are trying to include remote learning methods and tools that can still be used in face-to-face learning, said Aaron Horn, an official at the school. Horn said, "The college's instructors have also been including more class time to discuss social-emotional learning and trauma-informed care. Those issues are getting increased attention at programs across the country."
In recent weeks, federal workers have conducted large helicopter roundups to remove wild horses in the American states of Utah and Colorado. The Bureau of Land Management, the agency responsible for public lands across the United States, says the roundups are necessary to protect the environment and the horses as severe drought takes place. However, Animal activists say the U.S. government is using drought as an excuse to take out horses in favor of cattle grazing. Terry Messmer is a professor at Utah State University who studies wild horse management. He said, "What we're seeing here in the West gives some insight into a new norm." Norm means behavior that is usual or expected. The wild horses are largely descended from those brought by Europeans hundreds of years ago. Herds, or groups of horses, can double in size every 4 to 5 years. When populations grow too high, they destroy soil, reduce water supplies, and eat grass necessary for native species like the increasingly rare sage grouse, Messmer said. The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, oversees a very large area of land in the American West. It is also responsible for controlling the wild horse population. The BLM plans to remove some 6,000 horses, mostly from Nevada, Oregon, Wyoming, and Colorado, by October, a 50% increase from last year. Eventually, the agency wants to reduce the number of wild horses by 2/3. Without these measures, officials say horses could die of thirst or hunger. In 2018, many horses were found dead near a dried-up watering hole in northern Arizona. Horses that are captured end up being used by law enforcement groups such as the U.S. Border Patrol. They also go to prison programs where they are trained for future use, and others are made available for public adoption. Suzanne Roy is executive director of the American Wild Horse Campaign. Roy described the government's decision to control horses while giving a pass to livestock that have a greater effect on public lands as unfortunate. Ranchers say they have made changes to reduce their animals' feeding on federal lands. By taking water to dry areas for their animals, they have helped the horses who drink it too, said Hunter Ehrman. He is a spokesman for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. But Messmer said the number of livestock that grazed on public land is far larger than the number of wild horses. A key difference, though, is that livestock are part of the U.S. economy. Americans like their McDonald's burgers. They like their Big Macs. They like all of those things, and all of those things have beef as part of it, he said. I'm John Russell.
Scientists say they have used gene editing to block the ability of mosquitoes to identify human targets. The method is described in a new study led by American researchers. The scientists say the study could lead to major developments in the fight against mosquito-borne diseases such as dengue, yellow fever, and Zika. Such diseases, carried by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, kill hundreds of thousands of people each year. The researchers say their study is the first to closely examine the way mosquitoes use their sight to identify targets to bite. The study was recently published in Current Biology. The research centered on the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which bites during the daytime. Other kinds of mosquitoes, including Anopheles, hunt mostly at night. Anopheles are responsible for spreading malaria. Female Aedes aegypti search out blood meals in humans to develop eggs. They use several different senses to find those meals. One of the main identifying tools is the smell of carbon dioxide, CO2. When a human breathes out CO2, the mosquitoes become more active and begin looking for targets to bite. The research team said this search generally begins with the mosquito flying toward the direction of the released CO2. When seeking out targets, the insects search for dark objects. Once the mosquitoes are within close range, they can also sense heat from skin and additional skin smells to help guide them to a human. The researchers used the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing method to remove 2 out of 5 light-sensing receptors in the mosquito's eyes. They say taking away these receptors blocked the ability of the female Aedes aegypti to recognize dark targets. Craig Montell is a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who helped lead the research. He said in a statement that by removing the 2 eye receptors, the team was able to eliminate CO2-induced target recognition without causing blindness. Experiments were carried out with the mosquitoes in cages and in wind tunnels. The team observed the insects' movements toward light or dark markers to confirm that the gene editing method had changed their behavior. In cage tests, the mosquitoes that did not undergo gene editing sought out a round black marker after sensing CO2. But the mosquitoes with the 2 receptors removed did not attempt to move to the black marker even with the presence of CO2. The team then carried out a series of tests to confirm that the gene-edited mosquitoes had not simply gone blind. The experiments involved observing the insects' reactions to light, as well as taking voltage measurements from electrodes connected to their eyes. The results of those tests showed that the gene-edited mosquitoes could not only still see, but they could also identify different shades and motion. Another leader of the study was Yinpeng Zhan, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He said the research findings could have a wide effect on a series of insect disease carriers that can harm humans. Vision plays an important role in detecting a potential host for blood-feeding insects such as mosquitoes, kissing bugs, tsetse flies, and ticks, Zahn said. And this study is the first to uncover the molecular mechanisms behind this behavior. Next, the team says it will seek to identify other receptors used by Aedes mosquitoes to search out and feed on human targets. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of America's second president, John Adams. He took office in 1797. He had served 8 years as vice president under President George Washington. Now, state electors had chosen him to govern the new nation. Adams was an intelligent man. He was a patriot and an able diplomat. But he did not like party politics. This dislike caused trouble during his presidency because two political parties struggled for power during his time in office. Adams was caught in the middle. John Adams was a member of the Federalist Party. As president, he should have been party leader. But this position belonged to a man who really knew how to get and use political power, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had served as Treasury Secretary under President Washington. Now, Hamilton was a private citizen, a lawyer in New York City. But he continued to have great influence over the national government. Federalists loyal to Hamilton controlled the Congress. Even President Adams' top cabinet secretaries were loyal to Hamilton. In fact, they worked together against the new president. This political situation made Adams' term in office very difficult. It also led to the end of Federalist Party power. John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He says every 50 years or so, the country experiences a period of extreme partisanship. He says the late 1700s were such a time. That partisanship helped split the Federalist Party.
They never were a viable party again after the election of 1800.
Two major issues marked Adams' presidency. One concerned foreign policy. The other concerned the rights of citizens. The first involved America's relations with France. Americans were divided on whether to support the revolution in France. At first, many saw it as similar to the American Revolution against Britain. Vice President Thomas Jefferson especially supported the French. France helped America win its war for independence from Britain. The country's friendship continued when Thomas Jefferson served as minister to Paris. But many Federalists came to strongly oppose the revolution in France. They were horrified by the execution of the French king and queen. They did not like the idea of common people taking power. Federalists wanted an alliance with Britain. Over time, they demanded war with France. They used their power to prevent the American government from sending a pro-French representative to Paris. They also searched for any signs of insult, any excuse to declare war. John Furling says President Adams did not agree with the majority of Federalists.
Adams, from the very beginning, seeks and what he called an honorable peace. He tried to look for some sort of central position, centrist position, between the radical conservatives on the right and the radical liberals on the left.
Adams was afraid that the French Revolution would destroy America. He believed the American economy and government would collapse if the country became involved in Europe's struggle. So Adams tried to improve relations with France through negotiations. At the same time, Adams strengthened America's defenses. "We will be ready," he said, "if war comes." One incident especially brought France and America close to war. It is known in American history books as the X, Y, and Z affair. President Adams had appointed a committee of ministers to negotiate with the French government. French officials kept the ministers waiting for several weeks. While they waited, the ministers had a visit from three Frenchmen, later called X, Y, and Z. X, Y, and Z told the American ministers that France would sign an agreement if the United States did three things. It had to lend the French government $12 million. It had to apologize for anti-French statements in a recent message from President Adams to the American Congress. And it had to pay the French foreign minister $250,000. The American ministers were willing to pay, but they wanted to sign the agreement first. The French foreign minister refused. First the money, then the agreement. The Federalists finally had the excuse they were looking for. France had insulted the United States. The only answer was war, they said. Federalist newspapers added fuel to the fire by publishing anti-French propaganda. In a few places, pro-war groups became violent. The Republican Party could do little. Even Thomas Jefferson was helpless. He remained in Philadelphia, the capital of the United States at that time, but he had few friends there anymore. Congress quickly passed laws to create a permanent army and navy. It also approved new taxes to pay for them. And it passed two new laws by a narrow majority. These laws greatly increased the powers of the national government. They were known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. Federalists said the laws were necessary to protect national security. But in effect, the Federalists used them to weaken the power of the Republican Party. Under the Alien Act, the president could accuse any foreigner living in the United States of being a threat to national security. He could order that person out of the country. The act also increased the time a foreigner had to wait to become a citizen from 5 years to 14 years. Republicans were furious. Most foreigners, when they became naturalized citizens, joined the Republican Party. Republicans argued that the Alien Act violated the Constitution. They said it gave the government more powers than were stated in the Constitution. Federalists said the act was constitutional. They said the Constitution gave the government the right to defend the country against foreign aggression. The other law, the Sedition Act, barred the publication of anything that might incite public hostility against the government. Republicans argued that this act violated Americans' constitutional rights of free speech and a free press. Federalists once again defended it as necessary for national security. The Federalists tried to use the Sedition Act to quiet Republican critics of President Adams' administration. About 25 people were charged under the Sedition Act. These included several leading Republican newspapermen and a Republican member of Congress. Some of the men were tried, found guilty, and sent to prison. But other Republicans took their places in the fight against the act. The Federalist plan to stop criticism did not succeed. President Adams had signed the Alien and Sedition Acts into law. He believed they were necessary to protect the United States at a time when war with France was still possible. And his wife Abigail believed that passing the laws would stop newspapers from criticizing him.
The one piece of advice that she offers that is unfortunate and in fact catastrophic is that she really urges him to pass the Alien and Sedition Acts, which becomes the biggest blunder of his presidency.
Joseph Ellis is a history professor at Mount Holyoke College and the author of a book about John and Abigail Adams. He says Adams regretted passing the laws. In early 1799, Adams received several reports that France was ready to reopen negotiations on improving relations. He immediately nominated a new minister to France. Federalist senators threatened to reject the nomination. In the end, Adams agreed to nominate a committee of three ministers. The Senate approved them. It was many months before the three men went to France to negotiate the agreement, and it was many more months before they completed their work. But they did so on September 30th, 1800. After several years of bitter political struggle at home, President Adams finally prevented war with France. Later, he wrote that there was one thing he would like to be remembered for more than anything else. He gave himself the task of making peace with France, and he succeeded.
We can't say that about every American president, but we can say it about John Adams.
Historian John Ferling says he believes the United States would not have survived if the Americans had gone to war with France. Historian Joseph Ellis agrees.
I think that the long-term achievement of the Adams presidency is to preserve the coherence of a stable government and to see that the revolution survives and consolidates its energies and continues on into the 19th century.
1800 was another presidential election year in the United States. The Federalist Party appeared to be dying. The Republican Party had more popular support. It also had gained an increasing number of seats in state legislatures and in Congress. Party leader Thomas Jefferson was sure to be elected president, unless the Federalists could find a way to change the electoral process.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.